This is Fresh Air, and my name's Terry Gross. My guest is Cynthia Lennon. Back in the mid-60s, when teenage girls in America and England fantasized romance with their favorite Beatle, Cynthia Lennon held the position so many girls dreamed of. She was married to John Lennon. Cynthia Powell and John Lennon shared a working-class background. They met in art school in 1957 and were married in 1962. During the years John Lennon toured the world as a member of the most popular rock group in history, Cynthia Lennon was at home raising their son Julian. Cynthia and John Lennon divorced in 1968 after John Lennon fell in love with Yoko Ono. He was assassinated 12 years later. Now Cynthia Lennon is watching her son Julian Lennon become a rock star. He's already had one hit album. With her son grown, Cynthia Lennon has developed her own career as a designer. We talked about her memories of John Lennon and about the years she was known as a Beatle wife. First, she told me how she met John.
I met John Lennon at college when I went to junior art school and John went to secondary school. And I passed all my exams and I got into college. And John happened to be there the same year as I was, but in different classes, because the first 2 years is foundation course and you do different things. And I didn't really come across him until more or less the second year.
Was music an important part of his life then?
Well, he always carried around a battered old guitar over his shoulder, so I guessed it was at the time.
When you decided to get married, did you think you were going to have a pretty ordinary marriage?
Well, actually, we didn't decide to get married because it was a situation where we had to get married. You know, so we were rather irresponsible students at the time, and I became pregnant, and that's when we got married.
Did either of you resent that? Did you feel prepared for it?
Well, we were both totally shocked, and I was extremely ashamed because at the time it was a terrible crime. And it was something that we both were really, truly shocked about, but had to get on with it. And John accepted the responsibility, which was marvellous. I mean, he needn't have done, but he did.
Was he performing with the Beatles yet when you were married?
Yes, yes. He was just beginning to perform with Beatles. It was about the time that Brian Epstein signed them up that we were married, just about the beginning.
When did you realize that something very extraordinary was happening with that group?
Well, they were always extraordinary. Even as youngsters, as students, they were extraordinary. They had charisma about them. They had a great raw energy. And I think it was possibly when they were in Hamburg, when they first went to Hamburg, and they were out of the country, out of their hometown, and they were faced with an audience of ruffians and sailors, and they were working in the Reeper Barn in Hamburg. And they had to cope with different types of audiences, very hard, work very long hours. And that was when the magic started coming out, and that was their apprenticeship.
You were told by Brian Epstein after a while, the Beatles' manager, that you shouldn't be too visible as the wife. They didn't want the fans to know, I think, that that Lennon was married, or at least they didn't want to play it up. I mean, how were you told that? Did he tell you that directly?
Well, he didn't exactly tell me, but he did speak to John about it. And, of course, John explained to me the situation, because in those days it wasn't done for a pop star to have a wife. It would take away from the group. And, of course, the beginning of the Beatles, Brian wanted a lot of adulation from the fans. He wanted a lot of support from the fans. And, of course, it wasn't done. If the lead, in fact, the main man in the group, who was John, was found to be married, then it might take away from that particular success. So I walked around pregnant for quite a long time, hiding it. You know, I'd wear very big blousy clothes. And in fact, I was asked many times if I was John's wife, and I had to refuse and say, no, no, I'm somebody else.
Did John feel at all uncomfortable telling his wife not to act like his wife?
Well, it wasn't a sort of husband-wife situation, really. You know, again, it's very hard to describe because we had a son on the way and we were married very quickly and the Beatles started and the music started and the fame started and the press. And it wasn't a sort of natural, normal husband and wife situation at that time.
When fans did find out who you were, what kind of emotional reaction did they have toward you? Did a lot of the teenage girls really I hate you or become jealous of you because you had the person who was the object of their fantasies?
Not at all. Do you know, I was very lucky, really. I think I expected it. I really was a little worried about it. But all I've ever had from the fans has been love and support. And if there was any envy or jealousy or hate, it didn't come across to me.
Did they want to live through you in a voyeuristic way?
In a way, yes. I think the fact that they wanted to wear the same makeup and wear their hair the same way and wear the same clothes, and that was flattering in a way, but it wasn't antagonistic at all.
It's funny, you know, you mentioned your hair, and you've mentioned that John Lennon wanted you to look like Brigitte Bardot, that he was really fixated
yes.
on Brigitte Bardot.
Yes, he was. He had plenty of posters of Brigitte Bardot and Mylène de Mongeau and many, all foreign. And of course, a Liverpool girl trying to emulate that sort of style was something else. I couldn't change my accent to French, but the one thing that I could do was to grow my hair. And of course, I started lightening it and it got lighter and lighter. And then he was very fascinated with black stockings and short skirts and, you know, and for me it was difficult at first because I was pretty conservative. They used to call me Miss Powell. You know, they used to think of me as a sort of secretary type with specs on, glasses on. And I always used to be kidded about it, and they'd always say, oh, here comes Miss Powell. And this was before John and I got together. And then, of course, when we did get together, I just... I didn't fall in, but I was influenced by him a lot. You know, of course, I mean, I loved him. So I did as much as I could to please him in that respect. And I pleased myself as well, because I was a little bit fed up with being called Miss Powell.
What was it like in the days when you were a young mother and John was mostly on the road touring and he'd have, I guess, like a couple of weeks here and there in between tours to come home and play the role of husband and father? Was he able to make that transition from rock star and figure of fantasy to young father and husband?
Extremely difficult for him, because even though when he wasn't on the road touring, he was in the recording studio. So we saw very little of him. And when he did come home, he was so exhausted and so tired and so overwhelmed by the pressures of the outside world that when he came home, all he wanted to do was to collapse. And he used to sleep an awful lot. And he would wake up when we were ready to go to bed, if you know what I mean. With a small child, you have to be up early in the morning, and then you're pretty exhausted at night. Whereas John's hours changed. You know, he'd be up at night and in bed during the day. So the whole fabric of our life changed because of the work that he was doing and because of the pressures from outside.
Were you able to maintain a private life of your own?
Well, my private life was with friends, I suppose, the friends that I'd known from college days that I kept in contact with. I frequently went back to my roots, which was in the north. I mean, we moved down south. And I had Julian, who I loved dearly and cared for him most of the time. Well, when I was there, you know, I'd sometimes go away with John on holiday. But the problem with me was that I had to cope with a household. I mean, we moved into a virtual mansion. You know, as soon as the money came in, we needed the space. So the first thing to do is, if you're a pop star and you get a lot of money, you buy a mansion. But that takes you from one extreme of life to another extreme. And John being away, the house was far too large for me to handle on my own. So all of a sudden you find yourself with a chauffeur and a housekeeper and a cook and an interior designer and all the things in life that you've never experienced before and you weren't brought up to. I was left to cope with and handle, which was hard work. It was a full-time job, actually.
Did you get together with the other women who were lovers with or married to other members of the Beatles?
Oh, we were very good friends, yes. In fact, we were a tremendous family during that time. We were very close because we had so much in common, even though we all came from the girls came from different backgrounds. We sort of gelled because it was such a lovely group. We understood each other. The boys loved each other. The boys had a tight-knit understanding. And, of course, the girls followed on, and we were all very compatible girls.
What were some of the similar problems that you would share with each other?
I suppose being, to a certain extent, being left behind, not being allowed to go on the tours, which I understood. I understand even more now why, because watching my son doing the same thing. You know, it's very hard for a performer, or any kind of performer, not necessarily a musician, to give of their best when they're having to divide themselves in two with their emotions, looking after the person that's with them, who is demanding from them as well, and giving their all to their audience. Extremely difficult thing to do.
Did you want to go on the tours ever?
Well, I was allowed to go on the first tour. Allowed, I mean allowed. But I didn't ask. John, I think John wanted me to go because it was so exciting to come to America for the first time. I'd never been to America. And it was a treat for me. It was really a fantastic experience. But that was enough. I wouldn't want to have done it again. It was just too much.
What do you mean being on the tour was too much?
It was just understanding and seeing what went on a tour. It sounds extremely exciting. It sounds wonderful, you know, different hotels and wonderful food and seeing new places. But all we saw were the inside of hotel rooms, the inside of Cadillacs. We were surrounded by mounted police on one occasion, motorbike escorts on another occasion, trying to escape from hotels. It was quite horrendous, apart from the actual performances, which were fantastic. The rest of it was horrendous because you couldn't see beyond the prison that you were in at that particular time.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite, Murray the K and about five beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious, you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realised then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
Well, what would you do in a situation like that? Would you be the one to leave?
No. I mean, in a situation like that, no. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're not there, there's not a lot you can do about it, is there? And, you know, men are very easily tempted when they're exhausted and tired and they need not necessarily sleep. Yeah, I'm not being crude on this, but, I mean, it's one of those situations in that sort of life.
Did you ever have a desire to have other relationships too, since chances were that he was having other relationships?
Not at all. No, I'm a one-man woman. I always have been. And very difficult. You know, I suppose it sounds not boring, but, you know, in this day and age, there's so much infidelity and all sorts of things going on. But no, I'm a one-man woman. And I believed and loved my man at the time. And there was no way I would have dreamt doing anything like that.
One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it. But our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner. And after dinner, he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD. And, of course, it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds. And for me, that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture. And I couldn't cope with it. And I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug. So he tried it again. And then if you realise at a time like that, when there's so much money around and so many hangers-on, there are bound to be pushers, and there were pushers. We were surrounded by pushers. So there was no denying that there was plenty of supplies. You know, they didn't have to do anything. There were captive audiences to these people who are constantly pushing the drugs.
Did that create a wedge between the two of you, since he was living in an altered state a lot of the time and you weren't?
Most definitely, because it's a division of two minds, really. I couldn't go along with it. I just couldn't. I hated the whole business. I could see what it was doing, not necessarily to John, but to a lot of people. Lost a lot of friends through drugs. And with John, it altered his personality for me. I mean, I just stayed the way I was, and I always have done as far as I can. I mean, I've developed and I've gone on. But John was going so fast, and I couldn't keep up with him. And I didn't want to keep up with him on that level.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home. Really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. He wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again, and so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John, again, was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And, of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. I was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we're all devastated by Brian's death.
How did you first meet Yoko?
I met her, where was it? Actually, when I came home from a holiday. But I had seen her before. I mean, I met her physically, we could say. And she'd been staying with John the night, and I came home and they were there, which was sort of curtains for our marriage as far as all of us were concerned, really. But I had met her once before at a meditation meeting.
You knew right from the start, when you saw them together, that this was it, that this was different from just having an affair with someone?
Well, I keep saying it was feminine intuition. You know that something's going to happen, and only you know that something like that is going to happen because of your sensitivity and your knowledge of the person that you've been living with for 10 years already. You know exactly what's going to happen. And as far as Yoko was concerned, I knew there was not a thing I could do about it, any more than there was anything I could do about John taking drugs at the time. There was no way I could have stopped him.
He initiated divorce proceedings, right?
Yes.
And he accused you of adultery.
Well, you see, this is the madness of it all. I, to this day, don't understand that, but it's almost as though, I've tried to work it out, it's almost as though John's attitude in life was the best form of defense is attack. Now, he was guilty of letting me down in public. I was on holiday when the information about John and Yoko came out in the newspapers. I didn't know it was open to the world, the situation. And I was on holiday and somebody showed me a newspaper. And then an emissary of John's came over to visit me in Italy and said, John wants a divorce and he wants Julian. And there's a detective. Now, I was on holiday with my mother, my aunt and uncle and Julian. So God only knows why there was a detective put on me. You know, it was one of those situations that I will never understand.
You still angry about that?
No, I'm not. I'm really not angry. If I could understand it more, it would be easier. But I didn't get a chance to have an explanation for it. I'm not angry about it. I'm really not. It's just, it's in the past. It's finished. It's done.
Were you able to talk with him? Would he make time to talk with you about the divorce proceedings?
Not really. It was all done through lawyers and solicitors.
That must have been very frustrating.
It was very sad. Very sad that you were cut off so quickly. Cut out of somebody's life so quickly. But there's not a lot I can say about that.
I can't imagine what it was like for you, you know, to, after going from the, you know, fairly conservative childhood to suddenly being in the middle of all the Beatlemania stuff, and then it ends, you know? Then there's a divorce, and you're still kind of identified with it, but it's in a lot of ways out of your life. And you didn't have the money anymore either?
No. Well, I think it's called survival. It's simple as that. I think you have to survive, and you have to keep your feet on the ground and hope for the best and keep on laughing, you know, in life. I'm not laughing now, but, I mean, you must carry on. I had a son to look after. I had a child to bring up. And what if I'd fallen by the wayside, what would have happened to him? Very important. Julian was very important to me at that time.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Cynthia Lennon, and we're discussing John Lennon. They were each other's first spouses. When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. I mean, because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy, because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
How do you think his personality was changed by the relationship?
I think he found his space. I don't think he found the complete satisfaction in life, because I think he was always searching, always looking for it, always wanting something new, always. I mean, he was due to come back to England, you know, near the end, just before he died. So he was constantly changing and looking for new quests. But whatever he did, it was totally honest and wholehearted.
Did you hear about his assassination through the press, or did someone notify you before it got out on the wires?
Yes, I was staying with Maureen Starkey at the time, and she had a phone call from Ringo to tell her, so she told me.
You're still involved in the rock world now. through your son, Julian Lennon, who has a hit record and is, you know, becoming a rock star himself. Did you want him to be in the rock world? Did you have any queasiness about that?
Not at all, no. I encouraged him.
Really?
Well, I didn't push him, but I encouraged him because that seemed to be the only thing that he really wanted to do in life. That was the only direction he seemed to want to go in. You know, he would have been hopeless anywhere else, very much like his father in the early days, because academically he wasn't bright or wasn't interested, for a start. But he was artistic and musical. And, of course, if you see just a spark of enthusiasm in a child, then you will encourage it. And what has happened has been a revelation to me in such a short time.
A lot of people have remarked about how much he looks like his father and how he even sounds like him. Do you find that eerie?
Now, I did. I think following John's death, I had an experience of coming downstairs in the house I lived in North Wales, and he was sitting at a piano with his back to me, and he was singing a very soulful song. And I had to do a bit of a double take. It was a very strange feeling, really spooky. But from that moment on, no, because Julian is his own man now. And I went to see him in Los Angeles last week, performing for the first time. And I was really worried because I thought, what is this going to be like? It's going to be really emotional and highly charged. And I thought, well, I'll have to take a box of Kleenex with me because I'll be, you know, blubbing all the time. But I watched him, and, you know, I was so proud. I didn't shed a tear. It was such a happy event and a joyous event that boy has come out of a lot of tragedy and a lot of upheaval in his life and is giving his heart and soul to something that I think is wonderful, which is music and its communication. And I was so proud and so joyous about the occasion.
That was Cynthia Lennon, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Cynthia Lennon's son is Julian Lennon. She was married to John Lennon from 1962 to 1968. Cynthia Lennon wrote a memoir titled A Twist of Lennon. She's also one of the main sources for the new biography of John Lennon, titled Lennon, and written by British music journalist Ray Coleman. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical director for today's show was Mark Moss. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.